This is February 25th, 2015. This is Connor Fisher,
Jared Smith,
and we are interviewing Daniel Kelly. So, Daniel, why did you decide to join the military?
I initially joined the military because I spent a lot of time traveling in the Middle East after high school. And I wanted to go back to the Middle East, and yet I didn't want to work a real job, if that makes sense. The easiest means was to join the military, to get back to the Middle East, to travel again.
And what made you decide to join the branch you joined?
Well, the only other thing that I would compare to would be the Marines, and I felt like I was too intelligent to be in the Marines, if that makes sense. I hate to say that, but... also, I wanted to pick my own MOS, so I wanted to do something that was combat arms orientated, but also I want to be able to select my own MOS, so that was why I joined the Army.
Do you recall, like, the first day of your employment? Or, like, when you went and signed the papers?
I do. Yeah, it was... I mean, I was older. I enlisted when I was 21, so it wasn't, like, huge. I mean, it was a big deal, but it wasn't, like, you know, oh my god, I'm leaving my parents. You know, I hadn't lived with my parents for, like, 6 years at that point, so it wasn't really, you know.
Do you remember any boot camp experiences?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Boot camp is interesting. It's a bonding experience, and it's the most terrible, well, one of the most terrible things you can do at the same time.
What do you mean by that?
You'll find out who you are, that's for sure. It will, or it can push you to places that you never thought was you would be able to take yourself, mentally and physically. And a lot of guys don't and can't, and you see that happen.
Did you get close with any other people that were training?
In boot camp, yeah, absolutely. I still have friends that... one of my buddies who was the guy in the bunk next to me, like, I spent most of my leaves at his house. I can now even just walk into his house and be like, hi, Mom! And just, like, it'd be not a problem. Not as close as some of the guys I was deployed with or did other training with, but definitely, yeah. It's like shared suffering, so anytime there's shared suffering, you're going to get some sort of feeling of companionship out of that, I think, or camaraderie.
Right. Are there any experiences you can, like, that brought about that camaraderie that you can recall?
Specifically, not really in training. Nothing is specific in training. Just the fact that you're waking up at 4 every morning after getting a couple hours of sleep, 4 hours at most. And you're it's transitioning from a civilian to the military lifestyle and mindset. And you're doing it with somebody else. Like, you kind of have become this new person with somebody else. So kind of the whole process. Yeah.
You mentioned you had the opportunity to go over to the Middle East before.
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible?
After high school, I left and worked on ships and traveled for about a year and a half. I got off a ship in Piraeus, which is the western port side of Athens, and I flew to Tel Aviv and took a bus from there to Jerusalem. And I lived in Jerusalem for about 6 months and kind of put it around, went to Jordan a little bit, into Lebanon, and went to Turkey for 6 months, and I left, but that's how I did that.
You mentioned part of the reason why you joined was because you wanted to get back to the Middle East, mm-hmm. but you joined because you didn't necessarily want a real job.
Right.
So now, looking back at it, would you consider it a real job?
No. I mean, yes and no. The military is not the real world, that's for sure. It's harder than the real world. At the same time, it's a little bit easier. It's easier because, like, when you're deployed, man, you don't do shit, but do your job and hang out. Like, that's it. Life is very, very simple. You come back from mission or you don't. If you do, great. You get on Skype, you know, talk to the wife or whoever. And if, you know, if you don't, well, you have boots and a rifle hanging out for you.
Is Skyping pretty much the only form of entertainment you guys did? Or what else would you do to entertain yourselves?
Oh, man. Masturbation's a big one. I won't even lie. Now, to entertain ourselves, we used to do stupid shit. We'd shoot each other with the riot control grenades, the Nerf rounds from our grenade launchers, lots of PSP. We call it the Porn Station Portable because, I mean, that's what it's for. Skype when you have access to it. Lots of bullshit, just talking with your friends, who become more than friends. Lots of talking. Bullshitting, really. It's not talking. I mean, it's talking about, it's about everything.
Right.
And none of it's, like, you know, repeatable.
Daniel, could you talk about where you first deployed?
To Baghdad, Iraq, first and only deployment.
And it says here that you were drilled by the NCO and sniper/scout section.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate what that means, what that is?
I mean, when I first got in, so I showed up to my unit after getting injured in the Q course, and they were like, well, I showed up to Creek Company, which is like C Company, and I talked to the first time for about 5 minutes, and he's like, you don't need to be here. I'm going to take you over to scouts. They can probably use you. So I get over there, and then the PO talked to me for like, you know, 20 minutes. Then he called in all the NCOs, and they just basically sat me down and went over everything from battle drills to, I don't know, effective weapons ranges to just to basically find out what I knew, and to see if I was a fucked up person or if you know, if I was a soup sandwich, if that, you know, I don't know if you know that term. And after that, they were kind of like, all right, you're a decent guy, you kind of know your shit, can you shoot? So, and we shot the next morning, and it all worked out from there.
Tell us about the, so from basic training, you went to airborne school,
yeah.
And you pick up the story then.
Right, so in basic, I started with a ranger contract. I got recruited into the 18 X-ray delayed entry program, or direct entry program for special forces, just based off GT and PT score and shooting and all of that. So the pipeline is from Benning. We took a bus to Fort Bragg and did intake there. And we did something called SOPC, which is Special Operations Preparatory Course. Preparatory conditioning, depending how you want to look at it. I think it's the second one. And that's basically like 6 weeks of getting smoked and rucking and running and doing the Nasty Nick Q course at McCall and learning the pine trails. And then you do selection. Went through selection, got selected, got hurt in SUT, which is Small Unit Tactics. It's part of the Q course pipeline. They gave me a 1-year return date to return to Q course. They sent me to a line unit called Needs to the Army. So I went to 10th Mountain Division in Fort Polk, Louisiana, of all fucking places. And that's where it picks up. They put me into Creek Company and the first time moved me over.
You said you got injured or hurt? How did that happen?
I was moving my sniper team across roofs in Adamiya, which is in northern Baghdad. This is the end of 2008, so this is the height of the Sadr City Shiite uprising. So we were pushing east, and they were trying to push the Shia insurgents to the west and north up out of the city. So we were kind of acting like a cordon, and there was an armor push that way. So one of the, I believe it was the Cav Scout team, started taking sniper fire. A guy got shot and killed. So I moved my team across roofs to try to take out, you know, counter sniping. It's basic sniper work. And one of the roofs actually caved in as I was going across it. And I fell on my right side, 3.5 stories, and I hit And I broke two vertebrae in my lower back and one in my between my shoulder blades. And also hit my head really hard, so it was terrible. Yeah, and then that happened, and then I was medevaced out to Launceston, Germany, and then from there to Walter Reed at the beginning of 2009.
You said you had a year to return. Did you return in
No, I deployed in that year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the time you got hurt at SUT?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So at SUT was, we were doing just a long ruck, like a 20-miler. And my the upper muscle in my groin just completely went out right here. And I thought it was fine. Like, whatever, I've had pains like this, I can push through it. So I did for about a day or two. And it just got to the point where I couldn't walk, I couldn't move, I couldn't do anything. And they looked at it. I went off to the little tent that they have there. They checked it out. Then they ended up putting me in an ambulance and taking me to, like, the main hospital. And they said I had pretty much destroyed this muscle, so I don't know. Put me out. It was terrible. Especially after I've coming through selection, I've gotten so far to like be to be let down by my own body was like the that was worse than getting hurt in Iraq, I feel. You can probably appreciate that.
How was Fort Polk?
Oh my god. Fort Polk is the worst place in America, period. It's swamp and sand and swamps. It's humid. It's the closest climate to Vietnam that exists in the United States. So for that reason, during Vietnam, they initiated JRTC, which we call the box. So now we do training in the JRTC at the box rotations to simulate combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, which I don't understand, but it's still part of it. It's that or NTC, which is out in California. But Polk is terrible. There's nothing there. There's one strip club. It's called Pegasus. They have a midget. There's like two other bars outside of that. It's a Walmart. Woo! That's it. You know, don't go to Polk.
What sort of training did you do in scout sniper section?
Like our own training or I mean everything from how to set up urban hides to infill and exfill with we do it's called like the stay behind method, which would be like you kind of hide yourself in a line unit and they do like they'll be raiding houses and you just stay behind in one of these houses. So you practice doing that, practice doing rolling inserts, like jumping off of a truck while it's moving or getting back onto a truck while it's still moving. Basic observation stuff like sitting and writing everything that happens on a road for 24 hours. Everything you can imagine for some signal intelligence stuff too, vehicle tracking, ground monitors, if that I don't know how to describe that. Monitors that sense movement or disturbance of the earth so you can actually set up a perimeter for yourself. Tracking, bugging, things along that explosives, breaching. But that was really covered later on when we were deployed to by the AWG guys. The Asymmetric Warfare Group.
What can you tell us about your time on a Hunter Killer team?
So a Hunter Killer team is your sniper team, either of two or three guys, depending on what you're doing, and three to five scouts. So the purpose of that is to set up and overwatch like tier one sites, which are places where IEDs tend to go off, where we know a if we have like a meeting we know will happen, or if we know where somebody lives, who's a particular person of interest. Basically, you just set up this team. Your scouts act as your security and help you infill and exfill. And your sniper team actually does the sniper work. And so the HKTs are for security, because we were there, it was the height of the Tsunoshima Civil War. You know, sometimes your nearest exfil would be like 45 minutes out, just because the roads to getting into the neighborhoods in Mahalas were crazy. It wasn't like driving down the street. It's like driving down Manhattan streets. Oh yeah, and things blow up. So that's really for in case we get compromised. Like, they were super helpful for that.
Could you quickly give me a definition of exfil?
Exfiltration. So after you carry out your mission, you then have to get out of the area, preferably without being detected, but that doesn't always work. Just basically to remove your 2 to 7 men out of the area of operations successfully without taking contact, or ideally without anyone ever knowing you were there, but it doesn't always work like that.
Did you ever have any times where you were seen?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, it happens. Usually the worst are by, like, kids. You can't, you know, kids see you and they say stuff. Even if they know they're not supposed to, it's like, go, hey, look, you know, and then, dude, it's fucking over and it's terrible. So, yeah, it happens.
Did you have a lot of encounters with Iraqi dogs?
Dude, let me tell you about Iraqi dogs. No, I don't want to tell you about Iraqi dogs because they're fucking terrible. That's how bad they are. But yeah, they would eat bodies a lot. Dora Market, where we were at one point, was a big AQI, Al-Qaeda Iraq, like body dumping area. So they would capture or kidnap people, and if they didn't get the ransoms, or sometimes if they did, or if they just wanted to make a point, they would torture and discard their bodies in the Dora Market, because it's like the big market in Baghdad. So what happens is all the dogs who are hungry and feral, they're starving, so what do? They do what they normally do. So they feed on the bodies. So we'd have to kill a lot of dogs. And they would attack people. Yeah, dogs are a terrible, disgusting thing in Iraq. They're not cute. They're not pets. They're vicious. And they're all rabid, mangy.
Did any try to attack you ever?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Actually, our first team kill was my sniper buddy got jumped by a dog. He jumped on me, he shot it in the head. Yeah. That was the first team kill. Not super impressive, but hey. We made up for it.
Were the teams really tight-knit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, as you may know, I don't know if you do, but like in the military, you don't use first names. It's always rank, and if you are close enough to not use rank, then you use last name. So we got to the point where it was always first name basis with most of the people in the sniper section, but particularly in the team, like within your team. Yeah. And like everyone knew everyone's kids and their wives, and we were pretty fucking inseparable. To this day, even those guys are some of my closest friends.
Teams were about 3 to 5 man, but how big was the section?
Section was 9 of us, so it was 3 teams of 3. Well, 10 if you include the sniper section leader as well. And those teams could, like, we wouldn't always use all 3 of us every time out. So sometimes it'd be 2 people, sometimes it'd be 3. Just depending on what you're doing and where, you know, how busy you think it might be.
Just the situation.
Yeah, exactly.
How long did the teams work together?
We'd the whole deployment, and we were together. I mean, we didn't really shift teams. We rotated a little bit, like first and third shooters swapped a couple times, but like the sniper section as a whole, it stayed that way for the whole 16 months, and then, you know, year or so before that, all those guys were together, so they stayed. Some of the scouts shifted out from time to time, but we were pretty constant.
Did you ever attend sniper school?
Yeah. Well, we did the Robinson, the National Guard school, which is actually supposedly better. I don't know. So they say. I understand you're at Binning, so you're going to be biased.
What was that like?
It actually wasn't really that... It was good. I mean, it wasn't super hard. As long as you can do PT and shoot straight and... run in a ghillie suit that's soaking wet, you're fine. And don't have assholes on your stock lanes.
Can you talk a little bit about what a stock lane is?
So stock lane is... you're set up at a point. You have all your people, all your candidates for sniper school. At one point, you'll have like a guy in a truck holding a number or a letter, depending on a card. And you, between you and them, you have all this open terrain. So you have to take you and your sniper buddy, have to traverse this terrain in a ghillie suit and with a rifle and your sliding scope and your tripod and all of that. And set up on position. So you just go over to here. And you have to sight in on the guy reading the card. You have to say what you're... All right, he's holding an H, you know, a blue H or whatever. You'll have a walker, a cadre member, who's there walking around. So you call it, and the cadre member will stand within, like, 12 feet of you, and the guy with the binos of the truck will tell you, move 5 feet to your right, sniper. Negatory, there's no one there, or there is, and you're done. So if there's not, they haven't found you, then you take a shot. It's a blank, but you take a shot at it. Then they try to find you again. If they can't find you, then the third time what they'll do is they'll actually stand right on top of you. And if your spotters still can't see you, then you've passed a stock lane. So that's a stock lane.
So there's spotter and the sniper. Did you perform both tasks?
I could do both tasks. Typically, I was the shooter, though, because the spotter is always the more accomplished or the more experienced of the two, because spotting is really hard to do. But we switch over. You can't always be like, okay, for this firefight, you're going to be the spotter. Sometimes it's just, shit happens. And, Jed, my sniper buddy, would be nearest to the gun, and I'd be on the scope like, fuck, grab that, so... But typically, I was the shooter.
What was your time at Walter Reed like?
Walter Reed's terrible, man. Walter Reed is probably... I would rather be in Baghdad than Walter Reed, for sure. It's 8 hours a day of sitting in your room, all fucked up on painkillers, doing nothing, just waiting for like a year and a half. That's all I did. You have appointments every day, but after that, you just your place of duty is in your room, and it's horrible. We had I don't know how many dozens of suicides, and there was a big heroin epidemic when I was there. Like, everyone was doing heroin and overdosing from it. It was a really fucked up place. I never want to go back there. You won't hear about that in the news, by the way. They don't talk about how bad it is.
Walter Reed's specifically military hospital.
Yeah. It's moved now over to Bethesda Naval, so the conditions have improved a little bit, but it's still kind of the same. I mean, you have a bunch of dudes going 100 miles per hour, going to zero, and now they're fucking broken, and they feel like they can't do it, their job, what they've been called to do. You just have a lot of heavy depression, and people have family problems there, and it's kind of like if you had problems before, they're going to be blown up and magnified much more when you just have time to sit and do nothing. Not to mention you're on narcotics. It's just not... Sorry. Yeah, I'm pretty passionate about my hatred for that place.
Do you think that there's a narcotic prescription problem in the military?
Wow, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there is. I took myself off of my painkillers because I just didn't... I'd rather be in pain than be a zombie, and I have lots of friends who feel that same way. It seems like they don't want to fix the problem, they just want to mask the problem with take these pills and shut up kind of thing, and it's Well, it's like 22 veterans commit suicide every day. I think that's a reflection on the VA health system. And part of that is the push of pharmaceuticals.
what has your experience with the VA health system been like?
It has been like frustration and pain. it's lots of waiting. If you have an appointment, if I'm in pain now, I have to wait 3 months to get it looked at, which is ridiculous. And a lot of times if you, or like, I'm trying to think. Waiting. Lots and lots of waiting. Lots of people not wanting to help you, not being interested in helping you. Where when they are interested in helping you, they're too busy with all the, you know, hundreds of other people that were there before me that they can't get to me. So it's just, there needs to be a, something needs to change in that system.
Is that the reason why it takes so long to wait? There's just so many other people trying to get help?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of it. If it's more than that, then that's like getting into some tinfoil hat shit. But, I mean, I assume and I hope that's the reason why. Yeah.
Have you seen a difference in your experience with the VA before and after the scandal?
You know, not really. No. I mean, wait times went down by like a week. Woo! You're talking about like the scandal in Texas when they're, yeah. Yes. No, not really, to be honest. Unfortunately, no.
What was your opinion on the scandal?
I mean, it wasn't really surprising, to be honest. It's kind of like everyone knew that existed, kind of, but it wasn't like no one. We knew, but it wasn't like, it wasn't proof, if that makes sense. Kind of like, we've all known the NSA has been spying on us, but no one had proof of it until recently, kind of doing like, yeah, we all knew there was like a waiting list and shit, of course there were. Mm-hmm. But then to find out there actually were, you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. It's enraging, but you're already pissed off about it, so there's not really much you can do.
How long did you spend in Landstuhl?
Landstuhl was a week, maybe a week and a half. Not long at all.
What did your rehabilitation process at Walter Reed consist of?
It consisted of a full body brace pretty much at first, and then physical rehab, starting with the pool, and then moving to like table rehab and all of that. Speech rehab. When I hit my head, I received pretty bad traumatic brain injuries, so like my memory was terrible. I couldn't. I've told you what I did last week, you know, a year ago. No, maybe not, like 2 years ago, I could have told you what I did last week. I couldn't speak really. I could, like, what I thought wouldn't correlate with what my mouth would do. So lots of speech therapy as well. And lots of sitting.
What was patrolling in Baghdad like?
Patrolling in Baghdad is, I did a few patrols, but mainly I would do overwatch on patrols, or sometimes we'd be patrol with guys that do get put in, but it was the height of the Sunni-Shia civil war, so it was a little bit different. It was terrible. About halfway through, we started paying the Sunni militias, the former al-Qaeda guys, to guard the neighborhoods for us. We called them the Sons of Iraq. It was probably one of the worst fucking plans ever. So they would kidnap people, and they would rape inhabitants, and they would fight with each other. So if you weren't fighting insurgents, you were hoping not to get in between a firefight between Sunni Shia, and if you weren't, you know, figuring that out, you're hoping not to get in a firefight between one Sunni group and another Sunni group, and then if you were avoiding that, you were trying not to get blown up by the Muslims killing the Christians in South Dora, and if it was just terrible, man. Like, you couldn't really leave post without something fucked up happening.
What sort of pre-deployment cultural training did you receive?
That's funny. I mean, I don't Not really any. I mean, there's some, like, the basic briefings about, like, respecting mosques and don't touch women and all of that, but, like, nothing I can recall. I think we had some kind of death by a PowerPoint thing, but that's about it. Nothing intensive that I can recall.
So you learned about the dynamics of the Shia-Sunni communities on the ground?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like, they mentioned it, but no one really knew. Like, no one knows what that is going into it. And then you get there, and then you kind of learn. Yeah. First, we kind of got the info from doing ride-alongs with a unit that was there before. And then once we were actually boots on ground, we kind of figured out, like, yeah, what that meant exactly. Because you can hear about it, but when you actually see it, it's entirely different.
Who was the unit on the ground before you?
I don't even remember. One of the IDs, first maybe, third? I think maybe fourth. Which is the one with the Indian head. Do you remember?
Oh, Lord.
So you worked with... So I think that's first ID. Well, I can't remember.
What does ID stand for?
Infantry Division.
What's some of your most vivid memories from Baghdad?
One of the funnier things that happened was we were out watching an Iraqi army compound, and we believed that they were selling weapons or trafficking weapons, one or the other. We were supposed to sit there and find out. So we're in this, like, field that has this little ditch, just myself, my sniper buddy, and one of the scout sergeants, Sergeant Morales. And we're just observing and watching and seeing if an arms transfer goes down. And so at one point, Morales rolls over and grabs his rifle, and he has a grip pad on his light. So as he rolls over, he gets this, like, massive... It's like Batman beacon, like, wah! This is Baghdad. There's no lights. There's nothing. So all of a sudden, in the middle of this field, there's this massive surefire beam going across. And we're like, motherfucker, compromise us. So we had to, like, low crawl out of this field. I no one came and investigated or shot or anything, but... I mean, it's things like that. There's other things, of course, the shittier times, but... Those are the ones that... The funny things are the ones that stick the most, I think. Well, I try to make stick the most.
Are there any other funny instances?
I mean, nothing that's, like, clean. I have some funny stories about combat masturbation, but... I'm not going to share those. Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's... Yeah. Oh, we painted our weapons, and so one time I was outside... When we were doing time-sensitive target stuff, basically capturing high-value targets, we used female drivers because the females would also search females inside the targets' houses, because lots of times they would hide their SIM cards and their small pistols, which they're not allowed to have, on their women, and knowing we wouldn't search them. And then we'd bring in a female, and they'd just, you know, the faces would drop because they knew they're about to get caught. So I was talking to one of the female drivers about getting, like, the trucks and the radio set up and everything to go. And this E4 walks out, and he's like, "Hey, Sergeant, your weapon's pretty dirty there." You know, in my mind, I'm like, oh, shit, this guy's looking out for me. Maybe I forgot to clean something. So I, like, check it, and I'm, like, checking the magwell. And, like, no, I mean, it's pretty clean, man. What are you talking about? He's like, "Your weapon is so dirty, you can't even see the black on it anymore." And I'm like, holy fucking shit. Come here. Like, yeah, it was pretty bad. And I explained to him it was painted and made him look like an idiot. And then I could have smoked him, but I didn't. It was.
What sort of rifle did you carry?
Everything. So typically M4, obviously. Also an M9 for the sidearm. And then for the sniper systems, we had M110, which is... 7.62 semi-automatic. We had the M24, which is the bolt action. The 107 Barrett, which is the 50 cal. And then periodically we would take out the M14s as well, just for so if someone else in the team would have something to plank with. It sounds terrible to plank at people, but you know what I mean.
Did you prefer any of those?
Over the 110. I like the 110 of the most of it, I think. Yeah.
Did you ever take the Barrett out inside Baghdad?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah. That's a hell of a gun. and a lot of times we would take it out as like deterrent. We like to take it into the police stations a lot and just show it off, kind of. Because those were one of our biggest enemies there, were the police. I had a couple of friends get blown up in a police station in the basement. Yeah. Fuck the police. Coming straight from the underground.
You said the police were your enemies.
Yeah, the Iraqi police, man. They set up checkpoints and kidnap people. They half of them are insurgents or prior insurgents, or giving money to. Getting money from, I mean. Yeah. Like, if they said they had cleared something, shit was not clear. That means there's probably an IED there. The Iraqi army was a little bit better, but the police were just incompetent and evil, even.
Did you ever, like, go on a mission with any Iraqi soldiers?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We did all kinds of stuff with the Iraqi army. The IA, they're all right. That's not entirely true. They're kind of shitty, but some of their guys are not bad. The ISAF aren't bad.
Do you mean in terms of, like, training and ability to perform on the field?
Yeah, exactly. they were less interested in doing things for their own country than we were doing for their country, it seemed like. They would be totally fine with if we're getting shot at just, like, holing up and wait until it's over. Not all of them, but a lot of them would do that. Or they were just there for the money. I didn't really care. A lot of them were doing ecstasy and other things like that when they weren't on patrol. And yeah, the Iraqi army's pretty fucked up. Don't join.
Did you have Iraqi interpreters?
Yeah, we lost one of our interpreters, actually. Caesar, really good guy. Yeah, interpreters were super crucial for us because we would do... Lots of times we would, for the HKTs, the hunter-killer teams, we would take over a residence because we found out early on that if we set up sniper hides in abandoned buildings, they would rocket it. They'll RPG it. They'll take PKMs. They don't care. They'll machine gun the fuck out of it. But if there's people living there, they won't attack it. They'll wait until everyone leaves. So we started taking over residence and setting up from there. And so interpreters were always crucial for that. Like I said, Caesar was—he was from Baghdad, but he was from northern part. We were working in the southern part, and he actually got kidnapped from his home and tortured and beheaded. Pretty brutal.
Was he a Sunni or a Shia?
I believe he was Sunni.
Was there ever any want for you to learn their language?
Yeah, I am actually taking Arabic right now, and just from. Yeah, there was, yeah. I think I'm atypical in that I kind of like the Middle East. Most soldiers don't. I like the people a lot. So, yeah, I like the culture and I'm interested in the language for sure.
Do you think that has something to do with you spending time over there before your deployment?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. It's so different from the Western, particularly the American world, that it's... has this appeal to me that it's because it's so bizarre. It's so bizarre. I don't want to say bizarre. It's ethnocentric. But you know what I'm saying. Like it's nothing like the Western culture at all. That interests me.
Did you ever spend any time in Kuwait while traveling?
Yeah. Yeah, so Kuwait's probably the second worst place in the world besides Fort Polk. It's just sand dunes, and it's really fucking hot, and there's nothing to do. Literally nothing to do. You get to read sweet Chuck Norris jokes off of bathroom doors. That's about all there is. I want some medical training. Some weapons ranges. And lots of sitting.
if Fort Polk is the worst place in the world and Kuwait is the second worst place in the world,
Baghdad is the third. No, I mean, obviously, I'm being a little facetious, but Baghdad probably is probably the worst place. But as far as the boredom goes, man, Kuwait was just so terrible. So terrible.
What were your living conditions like on deployment?
They would change. So at Falcon in South Baghdad, we had the old Iraqi army barracks. But, I mean, we didn't sleep in those barracks very often. So it was nice, like, you know, if you got to come back in from helping another unit or helping one of the line platoons or doing a mission with an ODA or something, you know, it's nice. You have somewhere you can hang out with. But half the time, shit, three quarters of the time, you're sleeping in, you know, next to 40 other dudes at some cop company outpost. Or you're hanging out, you know, by yourself with a couple other guys in a house. Or so living conditions were less than desirable. But that's all right. You're not there to be comfortable. You're there to fight a war. So.
And you helped set up the compound Falcon, right?
No. So that's... We started doing something called...
How did you get from the United States to Iraq?
So we flew from Fort Polk to Maine, to Germany, to Kuwait, then to Bayop, which is Baghdad International Airport, and then convoyed south to Falcon. So it was like a 4-day process, maybe more, 3, 4, 4 to 5. I can't remember, because there was a holdover in Germany for, like, 24 hours.
What did you fly in?
It was charters up until... what was the last one? I think Germany to Kuwait was a C-17. I think. I know Kuwait to Iraq was cargo planes. I think we had two legs of that. I can't remember exactly.
You said you spent about 24 hours in Germany. Did you get to, like, do anything?
Hang out in a sweet airplane hangar.
Yeah.
Yeah, and drink some Rippets. Woo! It's a very miniaturized energy drink that tastes horrible. Don't. Never drink a Rippet.
Do you remember where you were at in Germany?
No, I don't remember the airport we flew through. Whatever the... yeah, I don't remember.
Can you describe Fob Falcon?
I was going to say it's like any other fob, but I guess if you don't know what that's like. It's walled off. There's a perimeter. So it's off of a MSR, a main supply route, which was Sonic's, Senators. The Senators turns into Route Irish, which is very famous. You may have talked about Route Irish in your class. I don't know. So there's like this main road that goes up. So you've got like the Baghdad International Airport over here. And then down here you have Falcon. It's square shaped. So you have your main gates. This is all walled off, and in here you have a couple stationary buildings, like main buildings, and the rest are all like plywood, shoes, and tents, and a Burger King.
You had a Burger King on Falcon?
Burger King. Woo, yeah. It got mortared a couple times.
How often did Falcon get attacked?
Oh, man, at least a couple times a week, for sure. They, I guess about 2 months there, they started moving from mortars to these things they called lob bombs. They just roll them up in the back of like dump trucks. And they were so slow, you could actually see them coming in. You could hear them. Instead of like the normal rocketing sound, it's like this whistling, like thunk. Whoa. So those were kind of scary. But yeah, we got rocketed a lot. We got to the point that we just didn't really care when we got rocketed. Everyone would be like running for their bunkers, and we'd be coming back from mission and be like, well, fuck it. If I get hit, I get hit. If I don't, I'm going to keep walking. So, with regularity, yeah.
Who were the guards at Falcon?
Some nasty girls, I don't know. National Guard guys, I'm sure. I don't remember.
Do you have much experience with contractors?
Some, yeah. We had an SSE team that would come with us sometimes, a Fox team, a synthesized exploitation team. And it was basically a bunch of retired or former operators, SOCOM guys or JSOC guys who quit to make the big money, to make the big bucks. And they would do sensitive site exploitation. They would gather intel, basically, off of target sites. Which we could do it too, but sometimes they like to come along with us. I don't know if you guys ever had them. No, probably not.
Was it weird to eat at a Burger King, eat something that was distinctly American, and eat it in the middle of Baghdad?
Yeah, it was really weird. It was... yeah, it was really, really bizarre to do that. We had a Pizza Hut, too. So, like, you can be in the middle of Baghdad in the shittiest conditions ever, and in an hour, you can be eating a pizza or having a Whopper or having a coffee from Green Beans or something, you know? Green Beans, make sure. Green Beans coffee. You probably know what that is.
So you talked about having a PSP earlier. We don't need to get into that again. But did you bring a laptop with you?
Yeah, I brought a laptop.
Did you have internet in your shoes?
Sometimes there was internet. Yeah, sometimes. It just depends. If there was a lot of heavy fighting that week and we took a lot of casualties or the units around the base, no, there was no fucking internet. Because they'd have to do call-outs for casualties, so there'd be no internet. Or it's also Iraq, so the internet sucks. It's not like you don't have Comcast. You have some Indian guy who, you know, installed it and barely keeps it running. Yeah. So sometimes. Outside of Falcon, no one had internet. So the only time we had internet was when we were actually on the FOB.
Which was rare. Were you able to communicate with home?
at least, I'd say once a week, but that's probably not true. I think the opportunity would come at least once a week, if not every couple weeks, you'd have the opportunity to shoot a line, you know, one or two line email or something, or use a sat phone to make a call. But that's sat phone, not as much. You know, Skype or email a couple times a week, I think. Depending on ops tempo and everything that's going on. So if you're out with, you know, I don't know, Alpha Company, staying with them and hanging out for the month, probably not at all. But, you know, if you're, I don't know, running Overwatch for a market opening or something, so you're coming back every night, then yeah, every night you can get on and talk. It just depends.
Was there the opportunity to, like, just write home?
Yeah, you can write letters. And
you just prefer...
I never did, but email, yeah, but no one... Well, maybe some of the guys wrote their wives letters for the romantic touch, but I don't think so. Not that I recall.
How often did you receive care packages?
All the time. Usually from people I don't know, church groups or small children. And it's usually useless shit, like socks and toothbrushes. I don't know why. Everyone thinks soldiers need 10 million toothbrushes, apparently. I don't know how many fucking toothbrushes we got. A lot. And a lot of it, like I said, is useless. So it wasn't like any big thrill.
Was there ever that chance that there was going to be the big thrill?
I mean, sometimes people might send you alcohol and mouthwash bottles and other things, but I mean, not. If you order something from, like, LaRue and you get it in, woo, that's about it.
The people who would send you alcohol and mouthwashes, those are people you knew?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That'd be friends. Yeah, you're not supposed to drink, by the way.
How did your family react to you joining the military?
Well, they were for it. I come from a military heritage, so I think they were nervous, of course, but they were... I think any time you enlist during a wartime that your family's going to be concerned, unless you join the Coast Guard or something, that doesn't count. But I think they were concerned, proud, but concerned, you know. As parents, in theory, should be.
After being injured, how was it reassimilating to civilian life?
That was very, very, very difficult. Again, this idea from going 100 miles per hour to 0 miles per hour. And the military doesn't, maybe it's just for injured soldiers, but as far as I know, they don't really have a good system for reintegrating soldiers back into civilian population. I mean, they have the method down to turn civilians into soldiers, like it's nothing, like that's, they got that. They don't do anything to bring you back. So I'd say I'm still fully not reintegrated. I still, you know, check my fives and 25s getting out of my truck. I still scan for IEDs. I still try to keep my back away from windows. I'm still not integrated. I'm still in this mindset of threat assessment always. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's, you know, better for me. But it's, I don't feel like a civilian. Again, I don't think I ever will. That's probably a good thing, but it's also kind of a bad thing, because I am a civilian.
How much of that do you attribute to being in the military and being deployed and versus kind of having the entire experience just pulled out from underneath you when you got injured?
Yeah, that's... See, I feel like maybe it'd been easier if I had, like, time to cool down or, like, time to, you know, be with my buddies on the plane and kind of process everything together, like, holy fuck, we just went through this together. Instead, it's, you know, you're on a stretcher with an IV with morphine trying to figure out what the fuck by yourself, trying to figure out what's going on, what just happened, and so it was really bad. That's one of the worst aspects of it, is just having it all pulled out. There's no even gradual cool down, you know, which coming off a deployment, typically, from what I understand, you have some minor bit of cool down.
But just having your identity kind of ripped away from
you.
Yeah,
literally, like, everything that I was, everything that I had trained to be, everything I had accomplished was just useless now. Like, I can be a police officer now. Woo! That's what I can do with my skill set. Well, I train, I had a training company for a while. So I can do that, I can contract, or I can be a police officer. It sucks.
I just want to go back. You mentioned that when you would raid houses, they would sometimes hide, like, guns on the Iraqi women.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen if those were found? Would they just be, like, taken away?
Yeah, I mean, typically we don't arrest the women or detain the women. That being said, we have had females in target packets come up before, so it does happen. But typically, 9 times out of 10, the target staying at that house is taking over that house anyway, so he's just kind of forcing the women to do it. Do what they want. But that one time, occasionally, it's, you know, it is a dude's house, or it is his wife, or it is his mother, and I mean, we can't really do anything to the women. We don't really do anything to the women. To be honest, it's not really... Not always. Typically, it's not their fight. Sometimes they pick up guns and whatever else, but typically we leave the women alone for that. We'll arrest the men.
Do you think that your actions made a substantial difference?
I don't know. I know that there are some evil people in this world who are no longer here, or no longer doing what they do because of me, and I'm very okay with that. I'm very actually proud of that. So, yeah, I think I did some good. sometimes you have to do some bad to do some good, though, so. But yeah, I think I did some good, all in all.
If you could do it all over again, you know, enlisting, deploying, being a sniper, you know, knowing what it cost you, would you still do it again?
Absolutely. Yeah. Except I would have gone a different roof instead of that one. That's about all. That's all I would change, man. I wouldn't. Yeah, I would do it again in a heartbeat. If not for the experience, so that at least so that someone else didn't have to do it. I don't know if that makes any sense, but some people aren't made for it, and they end up there. And you see what happens to those people, and it's bad. I would wish that on a new one. People lose their minds there, for sure.
You think that you handled the stress significantly better than others?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's... Yeah, I have friends that can barely function as human beings right now just because of the PTSD. And I have some PTSD, but it's not anywhere near as pronounced as what those guys did or have. Some of that's guilt, and I wasn't behind their trigger all the time, so I don't know. Maybe they did shoot people they shouldn't have, or I don't know what they did. I wasn't behind their trigger, but I think I handle it better than most people. Not most, in a lot of people that I've seen. And that being said, I've seen people who handle it better than I do. I'm not any fucking shining example, but yeah, I think. Yeah.
Do you think that might have something to do with the fact that your family's, like, been in the military before?
Some of it, yeah. My father's on the medical side of things, so he doesn't really... He kind of gets it, but not. But, yeah, a lot of that has to do with that. And a lot has to do with just because there's only 9 of us in our unit, as opposed to, like, 40 people in a platoon. We're so close. I've said before, there's people now that I can have a phone call right after this, and, like, if I was bawling my eyes out and saying some crazy shit, it would not be a problem. They'd be like, you know what, brother? It's cool, man. I got you. Can I do anything for you? Like, you know, do I need to fly out? Like, so we're close, and I think my friends help me through a lot of it, for sure.
Do you find that the ability to have people who get it, who can relate to you, do you find that's been a very kind of critical part in your adjustment?
Man. Absolutely, yeah. Without that, I mean, it's like, it's total isolationism. Like, civilians don't get it. No offense, nothing to you, but they just don't get it, man. Like, they don't understand what it's like to have been in that kind of situation and to have come out of it alive. And then to be thrown into the society where everything you just did for your life's work or you've done for your life's work is wrong. It's a sin. It's a crime. And, you know, it's weird, man. Like, our society glamorizes killing and yet condemns it so completely and entirely at the same time that sometimes if that's your profession, you're left wondering where do I sit? Like, what, how should I feel about what I've done? How do other people feel about what I've done? So if you have other people who can be in that same boat with you, you know, Caesar row a boat with, you know, 2 oars instead of 1 paddle. That was a bad analogy, but I think you get what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
Burton shared and such.
How was transitioning to the University of Oregon and being a student?
That wasn't really bad. I mean, I don't know. It was like anything else. There wasn't anything like great about it or anything hard. Go GI Bill, that's all I have to say. It wasn't that bad. I made most of my friends here because I've been vets, though, I've noticed. Kind of weird. No, it's not. It's not weird at all, but most of my friends I've made have been vets, so.
Do you guys have a lot of classes that are the same, or you just kind of met them?
No, we usually meet in the smoking area of all things. Sorry, that's incredible. Yeah, most of my friends I've met in the smoking area or friends of friends are like, oh, I know blah, blah, blah. He was a Marine. I'm like, I don't want to meet him. No, I'm kidding, but, you know. So friends of friends or over the smoking area or over a beer or something, you know? Yeah.
Is there anything that you would not want to leave unsaid at the end of this interview?
Needs to be some kind of reform within the Veterans Administration system. That's I can't reiterate that enough. Both on the medical side and on the bureaucratic side, it's a clusterfuck. That's it.
Do you feel that the VA's treatment of you has kind of betrayed the deal that the government made with you?
You took the words right out of my mouth. Yeah, I think it's absolutely an act of betrayal. It's not a feeling. It's betrayal, man. I mean, I literally sacrificed my mobility in most of my 20s pretty much to be told to fuck off. So, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.